step inside a damp stone cell in Manila.
Okay.
It's Fort Santiago, and the year is 1896, late December.
Right, so the heat is just oppressive.
Oh, absolutely. The heat of the Philippines is just completely trapped within these heavy walls.
Right.
And if you, you know, if you strip away all the history books for a second,
yeah,
and just look at the visceral human reality of this exact moment, you are standing in the room with a man who has exactly 24 hours left to live.
Wow. Just 24 hours.
Right. And usually when a person is condemned to die, especially unjustly, the psychological landscape is just chaotic.
Oh, of course.
You expect panic. You expect, like, a frantic search for a loophole, or at the very least, a desperate outpouring of rage against the people holding the keys.
Which is, I mean, that's just the standard hardwired human survival instinct, right?
Exactly.
When we are trapped, when we're wronged, the fight or flight mechanism just demands action. We scream, we curse the injustice of it all.
But the man in this cell, Jose Rizal, who happens to be, by the way, the most famous Filipino alive at this moment, he is doing none of those things.
None of them.
The atmosphere in this room is profoundly still. So welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today we are taking a stack of historical records, some literary analyses and companion notes, and we are really unpacking the final 24 hours of Rizal's life.
It's such a fascinating window of time.
It really is. Our mission today is to answer a historical mystery that honestly defies basic human psychology.
Right.
Like, how does a man facing a firing squad bypass righteous anger entirely? And instead, he spends his final hours crafting a secret, enduring love letter to a nation that isn't even free yet.
It's a question that really requires us to look at the mechanics of legacy.
Yeah.
Because we are not just charting a timeline of a famous execution here. We are examining how someone actively constructs the spirit they intend to leave behind.
Even knowing they're about to be silenced.
Fully aware that their physical voice is about to be violently silenced. Exactly.
Which brings up a deeply personal question for you listening to this right now. Like, put yourself in that cell.
It's a heavy thought.
It is. If you knew with absolute certainty that you had exactly 24 hours left on Earth, what would your final message be?
And who would you even direct it to?
Right. Because human nature dictates that when we are deeply wronged, our instinct is to demand that the world look at the injustice.
We want vindication.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And Jose Rizal had spent his entire adult life writing novels that brilliantly and surgically exposed the sickness of the Spanish colonial society.
He was definitely a master of pointing out the rot.
He was. So how does a man armed with that kind of righteous, articulate anger suddenly pivot to profound tenderness, especially when the ultimate injustice is finally handed down to him?
To understand that pivot, you first have to grasp the crushing, almost absurd irony of his situation.
Oh, the irony is unbelievable.
It really is. The Spanish colonial authorities had sentenced Rizal to death for rebellion and sedition. They were actively blaming him for the armed uprising that was currently tearing across the islands.
Which, just to be clear, based on every source we have, is factually incorrect.
Completely incorrect.
He didn't start the revolution.
He didn't start it, and he actually warned against it.
Right.
The uprising was led by a secret society. They were gathering arms, you know, preparing for a bloody, violent severing from Spain.
But Rizal was entirely different.
Exactly. He was the ultimate advocate for peaceful reform. His weapons were his two famous novels.
Right.
He believed in education, in societal evolution. He wanted to appeal to the better nature of the colonial government to just grant Filipinos equal rights.
He explicitly argued the country wasn't ready for a violent revolution.
He did. But the Spanish authorities, they are looking at a growing, terrifying rebellion, and they realize they are losing their grip.
So they need a scapegoat.
A colonial power in panic doesn't care about the nuance between a peaceful reformer and a violent revolutionary.
Right. They just need a symbol to crush.
Exactly. And they saw the most prominent, influential voice advocating for the Filipino people. Rizal was simply the biggest target available.
Yeah.
By executing him, the authorities believed they were sending a definitive, terrifying message to the masses. Like, challenge our rule in any form, and this is what happens.
So the peaceful reformer is the one who gets scheduled to be shot on the morning of December 30th.
Yeah.
He knows the timeline, he knows the political machine has locked on to him, and there is no escape. And so, on the afternoon of December 29th, in that stone cell, he sits down and does something just staggering.
Truly.
He doesn't write a frantic appeal to the Governor General.
No.
He doesn't draft a bitter political manifesto cursing the authorities. He writes a poem.
He writes 14 stanzas, 5 lines each.
Wow.
Entirely in Spanish. And what stands out immediately, in the literary analysis anyway, is what is missing from the page.
What do you mean?
Well, he gives the poem no title. He leaves it unsigned. He doesn't even date it.
Which completely strips away all the ego.
Yep.
He isn't acting like an author preparing a manuscript for publication. He is a man speaking into the void, you know, leaving a pure distillation of his soul on a piece of paper.
But writing it is really only half the battle.
Right, because the physical reality of his situation is incredibly grim. He is in Fort San Diego, heavily guarded, watched constantly.
Watched like a hawk.
If the Spanish guards find a piece of paper written by the condemned man, they are going to confiscate it, burn it, and the message just dies with him.
So the logistics of getting the poem out of the prison require a very specific, mundane kind of brilliance.
Yeah, tell him how he did it.
So he takes the paper and folds it up until it is incredibly tiny. And then he hides this folded paper inside a small cooking stove, an alcohol stove.
Let's clarify that for the listener, because it's so crucial. This is an everyday, easily overlooked object, right?
Exactly. It's basically a little metal lamp you would use to heat up water or food in your cell.
And that mundane nature is its camouflage.
Right. Later that day, his family, his mother, and his sisters are permitted to visit him for the final time.
I can't even imagine.
It is a heartbreaking scene. They are saying their permanent goodbyes, but amidst all that grief, Reisel has to execute this smuggling operation.
The sources outline this moment so vividly. As the family is preparing to leave, Reisel leans in close to his sister Trinidad.
Yeah.
And he deliberately switches his language. He whispers to her in English.
Which is so calculated.
Completely. He knows the Spanish guards, standing just feet away, won't understand the English words. So he whispers to Trinidad that there is something inside the little stove.
And the guard is standing right there, completely oblivious to the meaning of the English whisper.
It's wild.
In fact, the guard physically picks up the stove himself and hands it to the family as they walk out the door.
Wow.
The authorities literally handed the most subversive document of the era to the outside world.
I have to pause here, though, because this logic kind of baffles me.
How so?
Well, if we look at this through the lens of a spy thriller, the mechanics make total sense. Smuggling something out of a heavily guarded facility under the nose of the enemy, that's classic espionage.
Sure.
But the payload doesn't make sense to me. Usually, when someone risks everything to smuggle a document out of a prison, they are smuggling actionable intelligence.
Right, like secrets.
Exactly. They're sneaking out a list of traitors or secret blueprints to a fortress or hard, devastating evidence to just completely ruin their enemies in the press.
Yeah, that's the usual route.
So why prioritize a poem? I mean, if he is the brilliant intellectual the sources say he is, why not smuggle out a blistering, airtight legal defense that proves his innocence to the world?
Well, think about it. A legal defense argues with the authorities on their own terms.
Okay.
It acknowledges their court as legitimate. And a political manifesto, while fiery, has an expiration date.
That's true. Manifestos are tied to specific political moments.
Exactly. Reisel understood something fundamental about human nature and endurance. Poetry bypasses the intellect and goes straight to the cultural bloodstream.
Oh, wow.
A manifesto might convince a revolutionary's mind, but a poem captures a nation's heart.
That is profound. And the poem, which a friend later titled My Last Farewell, proves your point perfectly.
It really does.
It is entirely stripped of political jargon.
Yeah.
The opening line is simply, farewell, beloved country.
Yeah.
He refers to the Philippines as the pearl of the Orient seas, our lost Eden.
Yeah.
And immediately, he declares that he gladly gives his sad, withered life for the good of the country.
The humility in those opening lines is just profound. He is essentially saying, even if my life were brighter, even if it were fresher and more full of flower, I would still throw it down for you.
He isn't positioning himself as some grand, untouchable savior.
Not at all. He is offering himself as a willing sacrifice.
And there is one stanza in the sources that literary analysts focus heavily on. It's the Dawn stanza.
Yeah.
It explains exactly how he views his impending death. Reisel writes that he will die just as the dawn breaks.
Right.
He tells his country that if it needs crimson to color that dawn, to take his blood and pour it out to gild the first light.
We have to unpack the metaphor there because it's so powerful. He knows that political and cultural freedom is coming. He can literally feel the dawn of his people breaking, but with agonizing, absolute certainty, he knows the firing squad will ensure he never lives to see the actual sunrise.
Which is just devastating. Most people would despair at that. They would rage at the injustice of doing all the hard work in the dark and completely missing the morning.
But Rizal reframes it entirely. Instead of despairing over missing the daylight, he offers his own execution to be the dye of the new day.
Wow. Let my blood be the color of your morning.
Right. And that specific imagery flows into a broader philosophical concept running through the entire poem, which is the idea of dissolving into the land.
Yes, the imagery shifts to this surreal physical transformation. He pictures himself becoming the grass over his own grave.
Yeah.
He becomes the flowers. He becomes a warm breeze sweeping across the islands. He is explicitly telling his people, if you bury me, I do not disappear. I become the environment you live in.
This is the embodiment of a classical philosophical concept known in Latin as non omnis moriar.
Which translates to?
Not all of me shall die.
Oh, I love that.
He is acknowledging that his physical body is going to be destroyed at dawn. The Spanish will succeed in that. But the seed he planted, the example of pure love and willing sacrifice that will go into the soil and become permanent.
I look at that mindset and I think about, like, the architects in the Middle Ages who designed those massive cathedrals.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. They would draw up these brilliant, intricate blueprints, knowing perfectly well that the construction would take 200 years.
They'd never see it finish.
Exactly. They were laying the foundation for a magnificent structure they would never physically walk inside.
Mm.
Rizal's doing exactly that.
He is.
But looking at this from a psychological angle, I really have to challenge the purity of it.
Okay, let's hear it.
Is this poem a genuine act of radical Zen-like acceptance of his fate? Or is it actually a highly calculated, masterful final move?
I see what you mean.
Like, did he write something so heartbreakingly beautiful, specifically because he knew it was the absolute most effective psychological weapon to inspire his followers?
That tension between genuine spiritual peace and calculated martyrdom is exactly where the historical record gets incredibly messy.
Messy how?
Well, you're asking if his final mindset was truly as pure as the poem suggests. And that brings us to the contested shadow of that very same night in the cell. History is rarely as clean as a single beautiful poem.
Okay, so what else happened in that cell on December 29th?
According to the historical sources, there is a second, highly debated document from that exact same night.
A second document?
Yeah. It is known as the Retraction. This is a document where Rizal supposedly signed a statement taking back his lifelong criticisms of the Catholic Church and the colonial structure.
Wait, really? A full retraction of his life's work?
A formal written reversal. Now, looking at the historical debate, historians have fought over the validity of this retraction document for over a century.
I can imagine.
Some argue it was completely authentic, like a moment of real spiritual crisis and reconciliation facing imminent death.
Okay.
Others argue he was heavily pressured or maybe even tricked into signing it by the friars who visited him.
Right.
And then a very large contingent of historians believe the document was an outright forgery manufactured by the authorities after his death to discredit his legacy and confuse his followers.
That makes sense, too.
And the thing is, the sources show there is no definitive, universally agreed upon answer regarding its legitimacy.
Yeah.
We honestly just don't know for certain.
The cognitive dissonance there is massive, though.
It is.
I mean, I have to push back on the idea that both of these mindsets could exist simultaneously in the same room.
It's a lot to reconcile.
It is. You are telling me a man sits down and writes a fearless, transcendent poem welcoming death without a single drop of hatred or regret. And in that exact same window of time, he signs a frantic, submissive retraction, taking back everything he ever stood for. Psychologically, those two actions are at war with each other.
Completely at war.
Doesn't the physical reality of the poem, the fact that it was in his undeniable handwriting, hidden meticulously inside a lamp, and smuggled out using a calculated language switch, doesn't that prove exactly who he was and what he believed in those final hours?
It absolutely presents two incompatible psychological portraits. The retraction is a document steeped in institutional power, fear, and really murky origins.
Right.
But the poem is entirely undisputed. No historian argues about who wrote My Last Farewell.
We have the physical paper.
Exactly. We know exactly how it left the prison.
Yeah.
So when we ask what Rizal truly felt at the end, the most authentic answer is found in the undeniable ink of the poem. It is a man pouring everything out and taking absolutely nothing back.
That's powerful. But of course, a philosophical debate in that cell eventually runs out of time.
It does.
The ticking clock hits zero.
Dawn arrives on December 30th. Rizal is 35 years old.
So young.
He is marched out of Fort Santiago under heavy guard to a field at Bagumbayan. Today, that space is known as Rizal Park, right in the heart of Manila.
Okay.
He is brought there to face the firing squad in front of a massive crowd. It is a moment of such profound gravity that every single year since, the Philippines marks December 30th as Rizal Day.
Just to be 35 years old, standing in a field, waiting for the rifles to raise.
Yeah.
And yet, the last stanza of the poem he wrote just hours prior reads, "Goodbye, beloved ones. To die is to rest."
Unbelievable.
He is staring down the men who were about to murder him, and his final written thoughts are about rest and love. There is zero hatred in those lines.
And he actually refused to be blindfolded. He requested to face the firing squad, though the authorities denied it and forced him to turn his back.
Well, of course they did.
But that lack of hatred you mentioned, that is exactly what made the Spanish authorities' decision such a monumental miscalculation. Well, we have to look at the historical fallout of what happened the moment the rifles fired.
They thought they were solving their problem, right? Like cutting the head off the snake.
They really thought they were creating a symbol of utter defeat to terrify the population into submission.
Right.
But remember the irony we discussed earlier. Rizal was the most prominent voice arguing against a violent revolution.
Yeah, he was the one telling the secret society that peaceful reform was the only viable path.
So when the Spanish authorities take the one man advocating for peace and they execute him in a public field,
they are effectively proving the violent revolutionaries right.
Precisely. That was the mechanism of their downfall. By killing the peaceful reformer, the Spanish government convinced the entire Filipino nation that peaceful reform was a dead end.
Wow.
They proved that the colonial system was incapable of justice. The reformer's death didn't crush the revolution. It removed the only psychological barrier holding it back.
It made the armed uprising absolutely unstoppable.
Exactly.
Think about the mechanics of a pressure cooker. If a pot is boiling over, you have a safety valve that releases the steam slowly and safely.
Right.
Rizal was that safety valve. He was arguing for a gradual, peaceful release of the societal pressure. And the Spanish authorities decided the best way to handle the boiling pot was to weld the safety valve completely shut.
That's a great analogy.
The explosion that followed wasn't just predictable, they actively manufactured it. By trying to silence a moderate, they ignited a massive, uncontainable fire.
They proved his angriest novels right by silencing his most peaceful chapter. The poem he smuggled out became a rallying cry. It circulated among the revolutionaries. They read it in the camps. The man they shot transformed instantly from a vulnerable political prisoner into an invincible idea.
Which really brings us to the ultimate takeaway from all of these sources and how it connects back to you, the listener.
Yeah.
The story of Jose Rizal is deeply embedded in a very specific historical and colonial context.
Mm-hmm.
But the inheritance he left behind, the core choice he made in that stone cell, is profoundly universal.
It really is.
He had every right, every logical justification to be bitter, furious, and consumed by hatred in his final 24 hours.
Yeah.
Instead, he chose to craft a message of hope and love.
And the power of that choice is that you do not need to be facing a firing squad to apply it.
Right.
That concept of not all of me shall die, the idea that the physical self fades, but the impact remains, that happens every day in ordinary lives.
Absolutely. Your dawn might not be a national revolution. Your dawn might be your local community. It might be your children. It might be the next generation of professionals in your field.
Exactly.
The lesson here is about the willingness to plant things you know you will never get to enjoy. It is about deliberately choosing to leave behind love and inspiration, even in the moments when bitterness is completely 100% justified by your circumstances. You choose what echoes after you leave the room.
He understood that while the authorities could control his physical body, they had absolutely zero jurisdiction over his spirit. He retained total ownership of his legacy.
Now, before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, slightly haunting thought to mull over.
Ooh, okay.
Something that builds on the very edges of this historical account. Bring your mind back to the damn stone cell and those chaotic final goodbyes with the family.
Yeah.
Think about the nameless Spanish guard.
Oh, the guard who handed over the cooking stove?
Yes. The entirely oblivious man in a uniform who simply picked up a mundane little metal lamp and handed it to a grieving mother and sister.
Just because he didn't understand an English whisper.
Right, and he didn't bother to check inside. What if history is shaped just as much by the mundane, lazy, or oblivious actions of ordinary people, like a guard just doing the bare minimum of his job, as it is by the intentional brilliance of martyrs?
It is a staggering variable to consider.
Isn't it?
Because if that one nameless guard had just looked a little closer, if he had been slightly more suspicious of the weight of the lamp, an entire nation's founding spirit might have been tossed into a fire and erased from history forever.
It makes you wonder. As you go through your day today, what world-shifting levities, what profound hidden truths are passing right through your own hands completely unnoticed?
That is a powerful lens to view your own routine through.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the final hours of Jose Rizal. Keep seeking out the stories that challenge your assumptions. Keep questioning the mechanics of the history handed down to you. And whatever you do today, keep your own dawn coming.